Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Sia and GTM Research First Quarter Analysis Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If you would like to ask a question or have a comment, please press star one on your telephone keypad. This will place your question in the order it was received. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad at any time. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to your host for today, Tom Kimbiss. Tom, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Terry, and welcome everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Tom Kimbiss. I'm Vice President of Strategy and External Affairs for SEIA, the Solar Energy Industries Association. As you probably know, SEIA is a nonprofit trade association, and we represent more than 1,000 companies across the entire supply chain, all of whom do business in the U.S., but they're spread across the world. They do represent all solar technologies. And today we'll be discussing the U.S. Solar Market Insight, which is a quarterly publication we put together with GTM Research out of Cambridge, and we do so on a quarterly basis. Before we get started, I'd like to quickly review a couple facts about the various types of solar technologies that we'll be covering in our remarks today. We'll primarily be talking about solar photovoltaics, otherwise known as PV, which capture and convert sunlight into electricity. Concentrating solar power, or CSP, refers to a number of different technologies that capture and concentrate heat and use that to drive turbines to provide electricity. There truly is a lot to take away from this report, which is our first quarter report covering January through the end of March of 2012. And, Shale from GTM Research, Shale Khan, will go in depth later on with some of the highlights from the report and what we can also expect going forward in 2012. But first, I wanted to just take a few minutes to talk about some of the high-level reports, some of the high-level findings that we see, and discuss some of the factors that are driving growth across the entire U.S. Solar market. We installed over 500 megawatts of new solar PV capacity in the first quarter, 506 to be specific. It's just an incredible number. It is an 85% year-over-year growth rate compared to last Q1 in 2011. And again, this is during a time of consolidation in the solar industry. It's a time in which the economy is still trying to get on its feet. So to see this 85% growth rate was encouraging for all of us in the industry. We don't see this growth in installation slowing down for the remainder of this year either. In fact, we see it picking up. This report revises our previous estimates for 2012 in an upward direction. We now estimate that PV installations in the U.S. will exceed 3,200 megawatts. That's 3.2 gigawatts this year. What does that mean practically? It means that solar is now achieving a scale where it is significantly contributing to our nation's energy portfolio and its growth that we're seeing across the entire country. For the second consecutive quarter, we found California, interestingly, is not the largest market in the United States, and it had been traditionally for decades the largest market in the U.S. We found that in Q1 of this year, that title belonged to New Jersey, which had installed 174 megawatts of new installations. That said, and Shale may talk about this, there is a supply-demand imbalance in New Jersey that's troubling going forward for that state, and the legislature is working right now to implement a fix in that state. Other states that did see play a significant role in Q1 were Massachusetts, Tennessee. Tennessee made quite a strong showing, as did North Carolina in the southeast, which is not the strongest area traditionally for solar in the U.S. and continues this trend of geographic diversity across the country. Ohio saw significant growth. Meanwhile, states that have traditionally performed well and are traditionally associated with the solar markets in the U.S., such as California, Arizona, and Hawaii, did continue to install large amounts of new solar. So there's no slowdown there. It's just other states really picking it up. We also saw that all three major market segments, residential, commercial, and utility, had significant growth. So we're seeing this growth for a couple of reasons. First of all, the cost. The cost of solar energy has plummeted in recent years, and this makes solar more and more affordable for consumers. This is great. It's one of the objectives of SEIA, is to have solar widespread across the U.S., so we're thrilled about this finding. The average cost of a completed photovoltaic system in the U.S. dropped by 17% in Q1 compared to Q1 of last year. So that's more dollars in people's pockets, more savings off their energy bills. And more consumers are looking towards innovative financing models. We find that more and more companies, it started with just a handful, and now we've got dozens of companies that are looking and using and implementing different ways to avoid what had been the primary barrier for solar adoption for many years, which is the upfront cost. With solar, you're purchasing much of your electricity upfront, and that first cost had been daunting for many, many years and had inhibited some of the deployment across the U.S. We're seeing these new innovative financing models, such as solar leasing, really take off in many states in which it's legislatively allowed, and we see solar companies working hard and citizens as well to make sure that those models are able to be used in all states. The second reason we see for this continued growth in demand is policy, both at the federal and the state level. Nationally, our investment tax credit, which is a 30% tax credit that can be taken by the end user off the total cost of the system, has been the linchpin policy that allows new markets to emerge in state after state, as well as to help sustain growing markets traditionally that have been strong but are looking to become even stronger. That 30% tax credit is scheduled to extend out until 2016. So it's certainly been frustrating here in Washington to see solar heavily politicized as it's been in the last few months as we're getting into federal election season. Solar has become a political football for presidential campaigns to toss back and forth, not restricted to either campaign. And we feel strongly here at SEIA that solar is a set of technologies. It's not a political issue. It can be used by anyone across all 50 states, regardless of your political party. It's a rapidly growing industry that's creating American jobs now. It employs 100,000 Americans today, which is starting to make up a really significant chunk of our workforce across all 50 states and 5,600 companies that contribute to the solar economy, and many of those are small businesses. So we feel that candidates really need to recognize that while distorting an entire industry's record makes a great attack ad, it's counterproductive in doing what policymakers claim to be their most, you know, what they're focused on, and that's creating jobs. As I mentioned, we're seeing strong growth not just in the Southwest, but states all across the U.S., but it's no coincidence which states are doing well and which are falling behind. Those that are succeeding in developing strong solar industries, and along with that come jobs and local investment and tax revenue for local municipalities, counties, as well as states, are the ones that really have taken the proactive steps to remove those barriers that prevent solar from competing in the electricity marketplace. So these would be things such as allowing homeowners and businesses to have solar on their roofs, to interconnect their systems to the utility, to participate meaningfully in net metering programs that allow excess power that's being generated by homeowners and businesses back into the grid for them to be compensated fairly for that electricity that they're providing. And so those states that are doing moving in that direction with pro-solar policies, we're seeing those states really become the home of solar in the United States. The solar landscape is not completely rosy, and we see that in this report, and that's on the manufacturing side. Like competitors around the world, as I mentioned earlier, as all of you know, the economy is not in great shape globally. We're a global industry. We are affected by trade cases. We're affected by what's happening in the EU with some instability, as Germany and Italy are two of the largest markets in the world. We continue to face difficult market conditions caused by a global oversupply of photovoltaic modules made by companies who are not anticipating the economic downturn to last as long as it has. So recognizing on the trade front that new barriers will be bad for all parties, SEIA has called upon a number of its trade association colleagues, as well as APEC, which is the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, to start formal international dialogues on renewable energy between member companies. In other words, looking for ways to resolve future disputes, as well as to make sure that the current disputes that are ongoing can be resolved quickly and do less damage to our industry, and in turn less damage potentially to other industries. It's likely that the uncertainty in the manufacturing market in the U.S. will continue at least through the end of this calendar year, which makes 2013 very uncertain for manufacturing. But overall, the U.S. solar market is booming with strong growth, as I mentioned, and we are having new solar manufacturers enter the U.S. market. And I would make sure that we all understand that the jobs that are created within the solar market are not created solely by manufacturers. In fact, we're seeing a shift in the United States. Although we are seeing new manufacturing, we're seeing many of the jobs in the downstream portion of the job of the pipeline. So folks who are putting installing systems on roofs, those who are architects and project engineers, and suppliers and distributors are doing extremely well. Going forward, solar will continue to be an increasingly critical component of our nation's all-of-the-above energy strategy that I think both the President and Governor Romney have spoken about. Solar is strengthening our energy security. It's driving new investment. It's creating jobs. So as the market begins to grow, our installation projections between now and the end of 2016 top more than 25,000 megawatts or 25 gigawatts of new photovoltaic capacity. And this, what this means, it's a big number. What does it really mean? It means there's great opportunities for new jobs, for entrepreneurs to find new investments in this market, as well as great opportunities for consumers, whether families, small businesses, schools, hospitals, other institutions, to save money and to use solar as a competitive energy option that puts more, keeps more money in their pockets while we're struggling here with our economy. With that overview, I'd like to now turn it over to our partner, GTM Research, and speaking on their behalf is Shale Khan for his take on today's report. Shale?
Thanks, Tom, and welcome, everyone. Once again, my name is Shale Khan. I'm the Vice President of Research here at GTM Research, and we're happy to be releasing the U.S. Solar Market Insight Report for, I believe, the eighth time now with SEIA, and the market never seems to get boring. So what I'd like to do is just briefly run you through some more details behind the numbers that we're releasing today, what's going down, going on in the sort of nitty-gritty of the U.S. solar market right now and where we see it heading over the next couple of years. So I'll make a few brief comments on that, and then we can open it up to questions. So first, at a general level, Tom mentioned that the overall growth figures for installations in the first quarter of 2012 were strong. 506 megawatts installed, up 85% over a year ago, the first quarter of 2011, from a total of over 18,000 installations in the first quarter. Now, if you were to look quarter over quarter, you would see that the installation numbers actually decreased. So the 506 megawatts that were installed in the first quarter of 2012, that was down from about 781 megawatts in the first quarter, or in the fourth quarter of 2011. But I would caution not to draw too many conclusions from that. The reason being primarily that the fourth quarter in the U.S. is almost always the strongest for a couple of reasons. First, there's seasonal effects. A lot of developers try to get projects done toward the end of the year to meet deadlines for tax purposes or for incentives that they're trying to achieve. So the fourth quarter always sees this big boom. Second, the fourth quarter of 2011 saw a lot of utility scale capacity come online. And the utility scale market increasingly skews these overall numbers because you can have just one or two projects completed in a given quarter that comprise hundreds of megawatts. We'll see this happen when we release the Q2 data later this year, because Agua Caliente, which is ultimately going to be a 290-megawatt project, already has 100 megawatts online, and that the majority of that came online in the second quarter. So if you take out the skewing impacts of seasonality and the utility-scale market, this was a really strong first quarter in the U.S., 85% growth over first quarter of last year, and that implies that we're going to see another very strong year overall in the U.S., and I'll talk a little bit about where our forecasts have gone as a result of that. The other notable impact, I mentioned that the utility scale market is really what drove the numbers in Q1 to be lower than they were last quarter. If you take that apart and you look at the other two market segments, the residential and the commercial markets, both of those actually grew quarter over quarter. The residential market was up 12% from Q4 2011 to install 94 megawatts, and the commercial market was up 14% quarter over quarter to install 289 megawatts. And this is rare. You almost never see the residential and commercial markets higher in the first quarter than they were in the fourth quarter. So that's just another way to explain that this was a very strong quarter for installations in the U.S. As Tom mentioned, New Jersey took the top spot this quarter, and it's worth diving a little bit into what's going on in New Jersey and why how really impressive these installation figures are. New Jersey installed 174 megawatts in the first quarter of this year. Of that, about 123 megawatts was commercial. So the vast majority of the New Jersey market is comprised of generally large commercial solar projects. That 123 megawatts in one quarter of commercial solar is an enormous figure. Just for context, in the first quarter of 2011, New Jersey's commercial market was 30 megawatts. So it grew more than fourfold just over the course of a year. In one sense, that's a good thing. Obviously, we like to see more solar getting installed. But as Tom mentioned, New Jersey is driven by a solar renewable energy credit market, or an SREC market, that is pretty heavily oversupplied now and just getting increasingly oversupplied as these installation rates continue to grow. So we are expecting to see a downturn in the New Jersey market, though we may not see an entire crash as we've seen in some other markets like Pennsylvania. We think that given how far prices have come down, even with these lower SREC prices, which are down in the $100 range, down from over $600 a year and a half ago, even despite that, some projects are still economically feasible. So we'll expect to see a decrease in installations over the next few quarters in New Jersey. And then the question is, where will we be seeing growth? You know, where, if we're losing demand in New Jersey, where are we going to start to see markets pick up? And in the report, we highlight a few markets where we think that there's near-term growth potential. But just to note a few of them, I would say three markets where we're expecting to see a substantial amount of near-term growth in the commercial market in particular are Massachusetts, Hawaii, and New York. Massachusetts, we're already seeing this play out. We have a new program that was implemented in 2010 in Massachusetts that really only gained a foothold in 2011, and those installations are going in now. In Hawaii, the market is extremely strong thanks to high electricity prices that mean that PV is really already at grid parity in Hawaii, and so the only bottlenecks come in places like interconnection. And in New York, there are a couple of new bills that have passed and should prop up the New York commercial market, mostly starting in 2013, but it should be quite large over the next few years. So between those three markets, we expect over 100 megawatts over the course of this year just of commercial capacity. As Tom mentioned, we've revised our forecast upward this quarter relatively substantially from what was about 2.8 gigawatts to now a number that rounds up to 3.3 gigawatts. So it's close to an 18% upward revision in our forecast, and this is for installations in 2012. And there are three reasons for that upward revision. The first is just the timelines on a number of utility-scale projects. If you have a multi-hundred megawatt project currently in construction, you can have a big difference depending on whether that project has 50 megawatts or 100 megawatt portion completed over the course of a given year. So the first thing that we did is we revised the timelines on a number of utility-scale projects currently in construction that ended up showing a higher number for the utility market overall this year, around 1.8 gigawatts. Second, we think there's actually a lot of safe harbored capacity, a lot of projects that will qualify for the Section 1603 Treasury program, despite the fact that that program has expired now. We won't see the real impact of the tax equity bottleneck that we expect to come until late this year or early next year. It will be a bottleneck, but there are so many projects that qualified for 1603 before it expired that we won't be feeling that impact quite yet. And finally, the commercial markets, particularly in California and New Jersey, have shown quite a bit more resilience than we expected, and we revised those numbers upwards. So the combination of those three things led us to see have a much more bullish outlook on the U.S. market for 2012. Now, 2013 remains somewhat of an open question. There are a few factors that could impact demand in 2013 in potentially a negative way. Now, I should clarify at the outset that we do not expect the market to shrink in 2013. In fact, it would be almost unimaginable to consider the U.S. market actually shrinking year over year anytime in the near future. But we've come to expect such high growth figures like what we're reporting today that if the market grew by only 25% next year, that would, I think, by a lot of players in the market be considered a down year. Given that, the reasons that you could see 2013 slightly less rapid growth are threefold. First of all, the impacts of the trade petition and the import tariff on Chinese cells, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with, those were yet to discover exactly how significant the magnitude of the impact will be. In other words, we don't know what impact that will have on pricing yet or on the volume of modules available in the U.S. But what we do know is that if that does have any kind of a significant impact on the U.S. market, it's likely to be felt toward the end of 2012 or early in 2013. And the reason for that is there's a lot of inventory that was shipped into the U.S. in late 2011, early 2012, which is being worked through right now. Second, the impacts of the 1603 expiration, as I already said before, those will be felt early in 2013 primarily, and even a little later into 2013. And then finally, given that we expect a downturn primarily in the New Jersey market, but also potentially a slowing down in the California market as the CSI incentives start to tail off, we could see sort of a trough of demand in some major commercial markets. So if you add those three things up together, we're looking at 2013 and recognizing that there's a possibility growth could slow substantially in 2013. Even if that does happen, then we would expect a strong resumption of growth in 2014 and beyond. Finally, Tom mentioned the manufacturing landscape. That's the one negative part of the story for what's going on in the U.S. solar market. it is still a very difficult time to be a solar manufacturer. And that's true whether you're an American solar manufacturer, a German solar manufacturer, or a Chinese manufacturer, or elsewhere. We are in the midst of working through a substantial global oversupply situation for everything across the value chain. And as a result, prices have been falling, as are reported in this report and elsewhere. We saw module prices on average fall down to 94 cents a watt in the first quarter of 2012. That's the first time they've ever fallen below a dollar a watt. And beyond that, you know, capacity utilization for manufacturers in the U.S., the amount of modules they actually produced relative to what they could have produced, that's been relatively low as well. The big question is when we're going to start to see the global market recover. And I think that's a question on everyone's mind in the solar industry. To what extent will demand pick up and how quickly will capacity be retired such that we get out of this current oversupply situation? We're expecting to see the market get a little bit better for manufacturers late in 2012, but the real recovery won't be for another year or so. So in the meantime, manufacturers continue to produce and they continue to sell product, but recognizing that we are in a cyclical oversupply situation. And with that, I will stop, and I'm happy to answer any questions about the report or what's going on in the U.S. solar market overall. Thank you.
All right.
So I'd like to turn it back to Terry.
All right. If you would like to ask a question or have a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. This will place your question in the order it was received. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad now. We'll start with our first question, which comes from John Siciliano from Clean Energy Report.
Hi. I had a question that maybe it's not addressed directly in the Q1 report, but maybe you guys can address it. I was just wondering the pickup in solar development, if it had anything to do with the sort of retirement of substantial capacity in the coal-fired generation sector. And also, I just wanted to see how natural gas prices are affecting you guys as well.
Hey, John. This is Tom Kim. I think Shale and I both have comments on that. Thanks for your question. Personally, I mean, here at SEIA, we're not tracking in detail coal retirements. We see the we see this pickup really due to the reasons that we discussed earlier in terms of the cost falling, which Shale had mentioned, the safe harboring from the 1603 grants. Certainly, I think there is increased interest as the solar industry itself grows and is very small, obviously, compared with the coal industry. But we do have some companies that are beginning to establish more of a national presence. Companies, such as Solar City, Sun Edison, and others that are working at the residential level are becoming more household names where we haven't had any of those in the past. And that's just a sign of the industry maturing. So at the residential level, the choices that people are making who are living within coal country are finding that solar is still a viable option. I think at the utility scale, we have had extensive conversations with utilities, and they certainly are concerned about what to do when more and more coal capacity is going to be coming offline. There are, many coal plants that are scheduled to be coming offline in the coming years, which present enormous opportunities for solar and renewables as well as for natural gas. We see solar as being very competitive in the utility marketplace. Whether utilities we see probably a good fit between utilities that are developing natural gas and want to create more of a pricing hedge by complementing that natural gas infrastructure and generating capacity with solar, where you have a very certain fixed cost and no fuel price variability. It's a little bit, you know, it's definitely something that's going to be influential over the next couple of years as we see more retirements. But we think that this quarter's impact is probably due to primarily to some of those changes, some of those factors you mentioned earlier. CL?
Yeah, I think you hit on most of it. I would just briefly say my two cents is that coal plant retirements right now are primarily resulting in a lot more natural gas, just given where natural gas prices have been and the scale of those coal plants that are being retired. But increasing penetration of natural gas, to answer your second question, long-term is a good thing for solar because solar, when we get to high penetration levels for solar, given that it's an intermittent resource, what it's going to need to be supplemented with is either going to be some other peaking generation or energy storage. But when it comes to peaking generation, natural gas is really the best fit there. So from the solar perspective, I think right now the impacts of low natural gas prices are pretty muted because solar operates for the most part in a different landscape than natural gas does. And in the long term, low natural gas prices are ultimately going to be a good friend to solar when we get up to higher penetration levels.
Just one follow-up. Do you guys see any problems with the ITC in 2016 getting extended? I don't know how if you had a outlook right now, but given all the problems with the production tax credit and the possibility that it won't be extended, do you care about it, the ITC being extended, or is 2016, as I give you guys enough time to sort of use that incentive for what it's worth and let it phase out?
Well, this is Tom. A great question. The ITC is, as I mentioned in the earlier introductory comments, has been the backbone of the industry. And without an ITC, we wouldn't see the solar markets that we have today in the U.S. So we're very interested to see what would happen in a post ITC world. It's a little too early for us to comment upon the post 2016. To be honest, there has been legislation introduced in the Senate and supporters in the House to kill the ITC at the end of 2012. Luckily, those bills and amendments have been not met with a ton of support, but enough to make us concerned headed into 2013, where we may have fundamental corporate tax reform. So our concern at this point is making sure that the public, that the politicians really do understand the true value of solar and understand how much the investment tax credit has yielded growth in our economy, has created jobs for Americans across all 50 states, and that this is a job and economy booster, not something that's weighing on our economy. So I think our concerns are more immediate in regard to the ITC than post 2016.
Okay, thanks.
All right, our next question comes from Jeff Reiser with Platts.
I'm sorry. Let me just follow up on that, the ITC comments you were making. As I understand it, if I'm Ed's Bowling Alley in Omaha and I put something up on my roof, I could turn to the 1603 to recuperate 30% of the cost of my construction. But now, at this point with the 1603, if I start a project, I can't rely on 1603 money. I then rely on filing with the IRS and ITC. Is that correct?
Yeah, let me just clear up the couple of things. So we have a fundamental investment tax credit back from 2006, and that was extended 2008 for 8 years.
Right.
So that applies to end users, two different tax sections, but no need to go into that much detail. We've got, it applies to everyone with residential or commercial. That what we had under the Recovery Act was under the 1603 program that you mentioned, the ability for companies, and that would apply in your instance that you threw out there, to be able to get a upfront grant instead of a credit on your tax return, corporate tax return. So the amount of funding is the same. It's just a question of the timing. It also has implications as to whether companies have enough tax appetite, how much they owe the federal government taxes to be able to really offset a large credit that they would get. So it's right now, 1603, which was put in place under the Recovery Act, ended at the end of 2010. We were successful in getting that extended to the end of 2011. It expired at the end of 2011, and there's been a push to get it extended during the first first couple of quarters here in 2012. That has not happened so far. So right now, yes, you're correct. The 30% investment tax credit is still strong, and that is what a company would be able to rely upon to get, it's 30% federal credit.
But the safe haven that that Shale keeps talking about, that applies to those big guys out in the Mojave Desert, et cetera, who had construction underway by the end of last year. And they can recoup this 1603 money all the way up to 2016, correct? I mean, and so, therefore, what you're talking about, if you're estimating 1,800 megawatts in 2012 coming online in that utility scale sector, all those guys should be able to collect the 1603. There's an additional 2013, 2014, there's an additional, 2,000 megawatts that look to be about ready to come online as well, and that's when they collect that?
Just to jump in, this is Shale. The 1603 safe harbor qualification, that's not by any means exclusive to those utility scale projects.
Well, that was my question. If I'm Ed's bowling alley and I wasn't, how many of those smaller guys have gotten underneath the safe harbor?
Lots. Because you, as Ed's Bowling Alley, are not the one who was responsible to do that. Basically, the project developer, the system owner, the solar company that you're working with, they're the one who had to ensure that they had safe harbored product. So certainly most of the larger solar developers and installers did that. Doesn't mean that you have to be a large customer. It just means they have to be able to procure.
When you say lots, is there a way to quantify lots? Is that numbers of projects? Or when you think of it as lots, do you think of numbers of projects or dollars involved or both?
I think of numbers of projects and capacity installed.
Okay, and idea?
That's tough, but we estimated very roughly that we think there was around a gigawatt of safe harbored product toward the end of 2011, apart from those utility scale projects.
I'll be darned.
Pretty big number.
Yeah, that is a big number.
Yeah, and that's going towards residential installations, commercial installations, industrial,
everything
across the board.
Everything other than those big utility scale.
Yeah.
Real quickly here, you guys came out with almost 62,000 installation number in 2011. You're saying that first quarter was 18,000 installations. What do you think installations could hit for 2012? I'm just curious. Is 62,000, that of course had to be a record of some kind, right?
Yeah, that was absolutely a record,
right.
And we should well exceed that this year.
Exceed.
I mean, when you get, by a fair margin.
Okay.
An interesting point, if you're trying to just count up installations, a big part of that is trying to figure out how big the residential market is going to be, because just the number of installations there is huge on a comparative basis. You can have 100 utility scale projects completed and 60,000 residential installations.
Well, of that 18,000 in the first quarter, was that all residential? I mean, predominantly?
It's always going to be predominantly residential. I can give you the exact numbers if you want. Just give me one second here.
Because now you're getting into really significant numbers.
Right.
Yeah, well, Shale's looking that up. I mean, I think, you know, she is usually the one that's asking, you know, in this partnership we have with GTM to track the number of installations. I mean, for most folks, you know, in the investment field, they're hearing much more about the total capacity than the number of installations. For us, it's really useful to show the market penetration across the U.S. and across different segments. So, as Shale said, it's going to remain obviously, you know, highly residentially slanted, and we're seeing growth in all three of those, you know, market sectors projected for the remainder of the year.
And to answer your question, of that 18,000, about 16,000 are residential.
Gotcha.
Okay, thanks very much for the question.
Absolutely.
All right, our next question comes from Rich Bensaka from Eco Home Magazine.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, just a little housekeeping. If you could both spell your names and give me your titles, I just want to make sure I get that right. I didn't get the announcement directly, so I don't have that information.
Sure, I'll go first. It's Tom Kimbis, K-I-M as in Mary, B as in boy, I-S as in Sam, and I'm vice president, just leave it as vice president, of SEIA, Solar Energy Industries Association.
And I'm Shale Khan. Shale is S-H-A-Y-L-E, and my last name is K-A-N-N. And I'm the vice president of GTM Research.
Great. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, our next question then comes from Ivan Penn with Tampa Bay Time.
Hey, Ivan.
Hi, how are you all?
Great.
Good. Just wondering if you all can comment on why the Southeast lags behind, and particularly Florida, what the problem is in generating more solar in the Southeast, and particularly the Sunshine State.
Jill, you want to start with that one?
Sure. I mean, it's fundamentally it's a policy issue. Florida has no statewide comprehensive policy that is intended to drive solar installations. Florida doesn't have a renewable portfolio standard, which is the major policy that has driven a lot of the solar installations in other states. So, you know, if you look at where solar gets installed, it's really on a state-by-state basis. It's which states have the right policies in place, and that's why it's not entirely driven by whether there's the most sunlight, and that's why New Jersey was the biggest market in the first quarter of this year, despite the fact that there's plenty more sunlight down in Florida than there is in New Jersey. So it's really just a pure policy issue.
I have to add on to what Shale says, that when you're looking at, Shale's absolutely right, that the U.S. is comprised of both the federal market and these 50 different state markets. And even within those, you can have cities, you know, for instance, Austin was very progressive in their policies, mainly driven by their publicly owned utility, before Texas had even stepped forward, you know, as a state. So that's absolutely right in terms of policy. When you're looking at whether a region, a state, or city is going to really become a center for the solar industry, you're looking at three factors. You're looking at the amount of solar radiation or insolation with an O, I-N-S-O, L-A-T-I-O-N, that the state receives, which Florida obviously receives more than New York or New Jersey. You're looking at the policies that are in place, as Shale mentioned. And thirdly, you're looking at the competing electricity rates. So if you're in a very, you know, sunny area that's got some good policies, but you're paying 5 or 6 cents for for your utility, your baseload utility costs, you're not going to be as inclined to make that switch. So those are really the three factors that the solar market make in the U.S.
Okay, and just a follow-up here. The utilities here in Florida argue that, we need to diversify, and we have a lot of natural gas, so obviously there's a big emphasis on trying to build nuclear, even though it looks like the whole nuclear renaissance is not moving forward in any significant way, and that solar just isn't ready for prime time. Is that a Florida problem, because of the policies and utility rates, or how do you view the argument that they're making here?
I mean, I would characterize it as just a misunderstanding of solar that's been perpetuated for many years. And all you need to do is look around the country, as Shale mentioned, New Jersey, California, Arizona, North Carolina, I mean, just north of the border. We're actually kicking off on Thursday and Friday. Our CEO, Ron Resch, will be in Georgia to announce the formation of a new SEIA chapter, the 15th SEIA chapter in Georgia, where there's really an active and growing market. It's small, but it has that interest. So within Florida, there's enormous potential. It's one of the most populous states in the country. It has growing electricity needs. A lot of its energy compared to other states is electricity-based compared to other industrial and transportation, as so the air conditioning load in Florida. There really is a structure in which Florida could be a showcase for the rest of the United States for solar leadership, but it has to come through policy. It has to come through the legislature. It has to have support from the governor. In place down in Florida, you've got some fantastic resources. There's the Florida Solar Energy Center, which is one of the leading academic and research centers for solar energy in the United States. We have a very active chapter in Florida called Florida SEIA, with hundreds of companies as members. So they're pushing hard to try to get legislation in place along the lines of what Shale spoke about to really help Florida achieve its true potential.
Thank you.
All right. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at any time. Our next question comes from Chris Holly with the Energy Daily.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, I'm sorry. My question has been answered. I couldn't figure out how to get off the queue.
Okay, no problem. Thanks for dialing in.
All right. In that case, our next question comes from Zachary Shahan from Clean Technica.
Hey, Zachary.
Hey there. Hey, how's it going? I've got a few questions. Hopefully they're all pretty quick to answer. But first of all, PACE, a couple years ago, PACE financing was very exciting new development that was getting a lot of solar on rooftops. I know there's been a push to get it going again, but I don't really hear much big news on that. Any word on where that is, where that's going, if there's any hope for that?
Here at SEIA, we support PACE. We have not been very active at the local levels. Actually merged in January with an organization called the Solar Alliance, where we are doing more state work, but our focus has been primarily federal. Understanding that the one of the major holdups in PACE is with a federal agency, and we strongly support moving in the direction and influencing and working with the FHA and who else is FHA? FA? Yeah, one of the I can't remember the exact acronym, but working essentially with the administration to promote PACE, but we have not been very active at promoting it at a state or a local level.
Yeah, I'm thinking about clearing it up at that federal level, but okay. Any more on that, or?
Well, I mean, I think what it does bring up is you do raise a really good point, Zachary, in that PACE is an example of alternative financing mechanisms. And for those of you not familiar with PACE, did is they're essentially community energy bonds that allow homeowners to install solar through a very low-cost loan that's then repaid back through their property taxes. And it ran into a problem with mortgage companies that didn't want a new lien placed on the property for which they had an existing lien on, which made their lien secondary or tertiary. So in this case, it's a little bit complex in that you've got large banks pushing very hard back against this program. But what it does show is that these innovative types of financing can really make a difference. And part of the focus at SEIA, and I know across the solar industry, when we have, as we had had in the last few years, quite a downturn in the tax equity market, which has driven many of the large-scale projects using the investment tax credit. It's called for companies like Google and others who have stepped into alternative financing for solar, and MidAmerican and Warren Buffett coming in to provide financing that might ordinarily be provided by a bank or financial institution. The whole point here at PACE is really to try to find easier ways for homeowners in this case, but beyond that, to businesses to go solar. And it just shows that there are there's great opportunity for new creative alternative financing structures to help push the solar market forward in the U.S.
Well, you just touched on my next two topics. Of solar leasing obviously has blown up in California and in some other states. Has that development, which basically sort of fills the void of PACE, but in a more commercial way, has that development sort of shaken up your projections? Has it given you more optimistic projections, or has it all just fit into what you guys expected all along? And furthermore, do you expect that to continue to grow at a rapid pace, no pun intended, for solar leasing to grow in more places and to continue growing rooftop solar fast in California? And also the tax equity market issue. Generally I've read that there's a lot of concern about how much market there is there for how much solar demand there is. And there are other options. It seems like that would be more beneficial to solar federal policy options in the long term, even just getting that cash grant back. So any word on other options beyond options that rely on tax equity financing market?
Sure. Zachary, I'll turn it over to Shale. Shale, did you want to give your insight as to how the leasing market affected some of the projections?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this has been the biggest trend in the residential market for the past couple of years has been the growth of third-party financing and third-party ownership of residential projects, primarily through leases, but also through power purchase agreements. And it used to be that there were just really three companies a couple of years ago that were doing residential solar leases. At first, it was just SolarCity, Sunrun, and Sungevity. And now, by our count, there are at least 16 of them that are out there, and the ones that are the incumbents and bigger, which include those three, Clean Power Finance, even SunPower, that model is growing extremely rapidly. So the residential market overall has been seeing relatively steady incremental growth, but within that, the market share of third-party-owned systems has been shooting through the roof, basically, in any state where it's introduced, such that in some states in the first quarter of this year, you saw over 80% of the residential market comprised of these third-party owned systems. So that has a big impact on our growth forecasts, just largely because that model is still only available in certain locations, and it hasn't really penetrated everywhere yet, which means that as soon as it starts to bleed out into more places and there's more competition amongst these suppliers, we expect that to make a big difference in terms of driving overall growth in the residential market.
I would just add to what Shale said with just a couple of very short points. One is that it's clear that in terms of the smart money being on solar, that I mentioned Google making investment through the fund through solar developers. Recently, U.S. I think it was just last week, just recently, U.S. Bancorp also invested $250 million in this model with Solar City. There's banks that are really turning. It's mutually beneficial. You've got banks that are willing to make, and I don't know, we don't know all the details internally, but essentially it looks like some sort of equity investment or debt investment to a company to provide a fund of resources that would be otherwise unavailable. So we're seeing companies step forward and use that as a viable alternative to other investments across the board in this economy, which I think says a lot about solar and its profitability. Second, to your question about what's happening in Washington, I know that in the Department of Energy, Revenue Assistant Secretary Dr. David Danielson, he is very focused on alternative financing mechanisms for renewable energy, understands very well what's going on in the tax and equity markets and where there could be potential shortages currently and going forward. And they're taking a keen interest in developing and looking into how the federal government can provide support for alternative financing mechanisms.
Great, thanks. That sounds good. I'm obviously a lot is gonna rest on what happens this year in the election. So we'll see. Hopefully we can get better support in Congress.
Thanks for your question, Zachary. I think we're at the end of the hour.
Yes, sir, we have no questions remaining.
Perfect timing. So thanks. Thanks very much. It's been a great discussion. Shale, did you have anything you wanted to add at the end?
No. Thanks all for joining, and we'll look forward to chatting with you again next quarter.
If you have any questions that you didn't get a chance to answer, Jared Blanton is SIA's press officer and is available at 202-556-2886. That's 202-556-2886 for Jared. And he'd be happy to answer your question or get you in contact with the right person. Just as a reminder, that Solar Market Insight report that we put out, there's more information available on GTM's website as well as at SIA.org/research. So with that, I'd like to thank everyone once again for joining us today, and have a great afternoon.